If we could maybe sit down. Zach? Tom? Oh, I know. You're the guy who does not return my phone calls. A week ago. Oh, is this out in front of everybody? No, I left it on the phone that you said you do not leave messages at, and I know darn well you do listen to them. Okay, I'd like to call this meeting to order. I don't think we yet have a quorum, but we could get started, and I'm sure that we'll achieve a quorum at some point. So right now I think we're one short. Committee comment. Does anybody have any comments they'd like to do? No comments? I'm happy to be here. I mean, I'm just happy to be awake, to tell you the truth. Public comment, this is a time in which you can speak to anything that's not on today's agenda. Okay, we're moving right along. We can't do the minutes. I would like to hold off on 5 because I would like to at least have a quorum for that. And so what we're going to do is we'll go to the presentation because that is an informational item. Item 6 on the presentation of ABAG, BCDC, Regional Housing and Community Risk Project. Do you want to kind of tee this up?
Miriam actually is going to tee up.
I'm going to need a booster seat. Can I get a little pad or something? I need a phone book for Scott, please. Okay. No, it's okay.
I have a long chair.
The new chairs all be much taller. Okay, I won't be able to slouch, I can see. Okay, Allison, did you want to tee this up?
Thank you, Chair Haggerty, and it's a delight to have you with us today as our chair, your first time as chair. I'm going to hand it over to Miriam Chon from Planning Director of ABAG to introduce this item.
Good morning. This is an item that Allison and I have discussed a little bit. It's usually we bring you problems to find a solution. This is a solution to figure out how we can do more of this. It's a really exciting project in terms of the product and in terms of the process, the collaboration. A lot of good work at the staff level, which in this particular case, there are certain things that we want to replicate. Other elements, maybe not. This is a group that has really strong bonding that goes beyond the work. The three of them, Wendy, Dana, and Lindy, have had surgery, foot surgery, knee surgery over the past year. So they have a lot of efforts that they have discussed beyond work. But on the work front, housing, the title that they came up with, Stronger Housing, Safer Communities, it's about how we take care of our housing for more resilient houses. Flooding and earthquakes come to create problems in so many similar ways. Some of the science that we're using had to be shared. Some of the work with the local jurisdictions were on the same front. So this process started a couple of years ago, and a lot of credit to the staff for starting to figure out how to make those connections. In many cases, we have a lot of information, we have a lot of expertise, but it's very specialized. So to connect the seismic-related issue with the flooding-related issues, it was not an easy subject. It was not an easy process. But they started some of the collaborations a couple of years ago, a lot of conversations, a lot of comparing notes, a lot of understanding of how we work with our cities and who in the cities do we work with. That led to more specific engagement through the ART project first, and then through a grant that was provided by EPA to identify a specific point of convergence. So the work that was started by staff in terms of casual conversation, we were able to carry that into the funding process, which is a huge constraint in our work. As you know, our grants come with very specific boundaries for very specific tasks, so they managed to scope a grant that could allow for this level of collaboration. And I think the result that we're having is a much more efficient process of coordinating with your staff at the city level. Instead of calling them twice, we're calling them them once to get all the information. And instead of just getting a strategy that deals with flooding separate from a strategy that deals with seismic risk, here we're dealing with both risks at the same time, and we have a more comprehensive strategy. So it has been a pleasure to work with Wendy and Lindy, and you'll see some of the specifics of the process as well as the product. Wendy and Dina?
Okay.
If you could announce what bone you broke or surgery.
I had a baby, actually, so I'm back. I'm recovered now. My name's Abby Hall. I work for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and I work for the Office of Sustainable Communities. We're the smart growth arm of EPA, and we were really excited to award this technical assistance to ABAG and BCDC because we've been struggling, quite frankly, for a while in the smart growth world about how to make sure smart growth is safe growth. And it's been sort of a touchy conversation to dig in and be honest about the vulnerabilities that we face in some of these areas where we want to direct a lot of our new investments and our new growth. So in my office, we'd been wanting to see a project that we could work on with a community or region in this case that helped us sort of grapple with some of those thornier issues. And it's been a total joy to work with Dana and Wendy and Lindy and the rest of the staff at ABAG and BCDC, who are highly skilled and able to really help us learn a lot at EPA. And we're hoping to carry some of these lessons forward. And I'll mention, this was a collaboration on many levels. The funding for this project actually came from FEMA Region 9. FEMA transferred the funds over to our office, and then we provided the direct contract support. And part of that is we wanted to make sure to leverage FEMA's planning processes. I mean, they have a lot of plans and requirements that they put on regions and communities, and we wanted to make sure to bring those in, to have those under consideration as we were diving into this project and really looking at the priority development areas and assessing the earthquake, sea level rise, and flood risks that are faced here in the region. And so I want to thank the team for being so nice to work with. Sometimes we provide technical assistance, and we do all the heavy lifting with our consultants. And in this case, I would say this team did a ton of the heavy lifting, and we got some good work out of our consultants, AECOM, as well. But it's really been a nice collaboration. So the other thing that I'll just mention is that we've been so pleased with the final products from this work, both the vulnerability assessment piece and then the resilience strategies that have come out of the work, that FEMA is putting up additional money, and we're going to take these strategies and try to sort of expand and tailor them to other parts of California. So FEMA's interested in adding drought and wildfire risks to earthquake and sea level rise and working with some other regions in California that face those other types of risks and trying to make sure that their sustainable community strategies also address these hazards and think about vulnerabilities to housing. So we have yet to sort of approach the state, but I do hope to, you know, I have some good contacts in the state. I do hope to work with them around how this might be used in other parts of the region and implementing SB 375. And I hope that we can continue to collaborate with this team because I know that they're going to take it forward with the localities around the Bay Area, and we'll be interested to see how that sort of further implementation works.
Wow. Well, that was a rousing introduction to this project, which I will say we have all really enjoyed working on, as you can tell. And no, you can join this team and not have surgery or be injured in some way. You can. You're welcome. So it's my pleasure to speak to you today a little bit about the project, what the background was for starting this project, and then I want to focus on what some of the outcomes and findings are. And then Dana is going to walk you through in real time on the website, the ABAG website, where you can actually get the information about this project and where you others, local agencies and others can see how the project unfolded and get resources that they can use themselves. So what were the goals of the project? Well, really, we wanted to understand better what the vulnerabilities of housing and communities were to earthquakes and flooding risks. We wanted to identify what the consequences of those vulnerabilities were going to be on those communities, not only existing communities, but new communities in areas that are projected to grow. And then we wanted to focus on identifying strategies to reduce those risks and really base those on the kinds of challenges that we saw, both in existing and future housing, and for communities of, with different kinds of characteristics. And then lastly, it was very important for us that we crafted this information in a way that was easily understood, very actionable, and usable at all different scales, both local to regional and statewide, so that this work we've done actually translates into action. One of the questions we had to answer early on a couple times over and over again, and Dana has this wrapped down probably a little bit better than I do, is why focus on housing and communities? A lot of our work to date in the Adapting to Rising Tides project has been multi-sector. The ABAG Resilience Program has been looking at seismic risks on all kinds of assets and infrastructure. But why housing and communities? It's really important, we felt, to focus on people in their homes, because recovery will really depend on how fast and whether people can stay in their homes. If we have homes that have to be rebuilt, if money has to be found for that rebuilding, if time has to be taken for that rebuilding, it's fairly likely that those who live in those communities will leave. That means the businesses and the services they rely on, the schools they go to, those social connections that have been made, those will be broken and they're not easily reformed. The other issue is that rental housing that gets damaged and rebuilt can often be returned at market rate. And we know the affordability challenges in the region, not just for home ownership, but for renting. And so everything we can do to improve the chance that people can stay in their homes is going to accelerate recovery. We also know that knowing what the risks are and the chance of this happening, of where recovery can be slowed or stalled, well, if we identify those challenges, we can find solutions or start to look for solutions and get ahead of that challenge. This project was highly collaborative. It was collaborative by design because we knew that although we have good experience and technical knowledge under our belts, both at the BCDC Adapting to Rising Tides Program and ABAG's Resilience Program, that this is a technical, there are technical components of this issue and challenges, and that to be locally actionable, the strategies need to be easily walked up to by those who are going to use them. So we had our two projects led the work. We had an advisory committee of technical experts in housing hazards and community risk. We had Bay Area stakeholders help us evaluate the strategies and how, not just the strategies we were presenting, but how we presented them, the kind of information that they needed so they could take them and walk out the door and use them. We also had a great set of funders. This was, as Miriam pointed out, a collaboration of funding that was really great timing for us that we brought all this money together at once. And then we had a strategy consultant to help us fill in the gaps where we were resource limited, which was very helpful. As Miriam indicated, one of the things that we really enjoy about this project and we look forward to in the future is that it really solidified the two programs, the Adapting to Rising Tides program and the Resilience program, working together. In about 2010, 2011, you've all heard about the Adapting to Rising Tides pilot program in Alameda County. That project was spinning up at about the same time as the regional hazard mitigation planning effort. The ART program and their partners focused on transportation and a lot of different other assets at the same time that the hazard mitigation plan effort was ongoing. But we identified this overlap between our two programs to focus on housing and communities and how important it was going to be. And what it's leading to is it's leading to stronger and stronger collaborations among all of the projects. We're now leading a project in Contra Costa County on adapting to rising tides, and we have ABAG with us helping. We're working with ABAG on the resilience, on the regional resilience, regional hazard mitigation plan update, or local hazard mitigation plan updates, which will look at hazards and climate adaptation. And then all of us together are helping with resilience in the sustainable community strategy update. So really, we have heard that we need to work together, and we have found a way to do so. So back to the project at hand. One of the things that we needed to do is figure out how to really understand the risks that housing and communities faced. And so the first choice was, well, what hazards do we look at? We looked at flooding, we looked at seismic risk, and then we looked at the intersection between those two that's going to occur along the shoreline, where we're going to have flooding, flood risks, and liquefaction risks, where the earth gets not so solid, and you have liquefaction occurring. We spent a lot of time looking at fragile housing, or trying to understand how do you know what housing is likely at risk to become red tagged or not livable or needed to be rebuilt in any one of these situations, these hazard situations, seismic, ground shaking, liquefaction, or flooding. We identified 8 housing types, and we used regionally available data to create regional maps of where those housing types are likely to occur as a first pass at where you need to dig in and focus more on what kind of housing you actually have on the ground. We also looked at communities at risk, and this process leveraged and sort of built on what MTC's Community of Concern effort, and that effort for the Sustainable Community Strategies, really started with. We used the same methodology. We modeled our analysis after that analysis, and we identified characteristics that make individuals, households, and neighborhoods more at risk. And the risks here are about recovery, most importantly, but also about the preparedness and the response of these communities to either flooding or seismic risks. We looked at these 3 characteristics, hazards, housing, and communities, at 2 scales. And the reason we did that is because at the regional scale, I don't need to tell you how large of an area we are looking at for the 9 counties, it's very important that we have a way to refine, to hone in, to find those areas that have communities at risk living in fragile housing. And so the larger assessment has mapped out the characteristics that I explained in the last couple of slides and helps us focus in on areas where we really need to refine our understanding of what's happening on the ground. We also looked at a community scale. We had 8 communities. They were based on local interest. We had from our advisory group and the stakeholders. We zoomed in and we looked at what happens at that local community scale. The reason we did this is because we all live in a community. We all know that in some neighborhoods we have stronger connections than others. There are characteristics of communities you cannot measure regionally that really come to bear when it comes to resilience and recovery. So we looked at these 2 scales, and the maps and the analysis and the outcomes are all on the website, which Dana will get to in a moment. Just wanted to briefly touch on some of the overarching findings from the project. One of the challenges in our region is that housing is generally built to life safety rather than shelter-in-place standards. That means that lives will be saved, but you won't be able to stay in your neighborhood. And that will be a very challenging situation for recovery. When we get people leaving, it's less likely they'll come back. Most of the foundations in our region for single-family and some multifamily homes cannot withstand liquefaction. And so they will be red tagged and they will have to be rebuilt. And this is a very large challenge for us. And then in our region, we're not used to having our homes flood. And so our homes are not floodproof. They will be damaged by flooding. There's almost no locations around the Bay shoreline, except for a few where homes are built up on piers above flood level, that a home can tolerate getting wet. We also found that, as we all know, and it's becoming more and more prevalent in the news, that housing affordability is a significant existing challenge, and that is going to make recovery even harder. Our region has expensive homes to buy and expensive homes to rent. And so when you think about what happens during recovery, those costs are only going to go up. We also know that renters have a very limited ability to improve the resilience of the homes they live in. They don't own them, and they cannot really improve them. They can't add seismic. They can't retrofit them for seismic. It's not their home to do so. And then we have communities. We have a very rich and diverse region, and we have communities that are not getting the appropriate information in a way that they can understand about the risks they face and what they can actually do to start to protect themselves against these hazards. So based on that understanding of where we have hazards and housing and communities at risk in the same location, we started to develop strategies. And there's a lot of strategies. I think we ended up with 40 odd strategies. Maybe not odd strategies, but 40 strategies. And there's a large suite of them. And the goal was to really think about strategies to improve the likelihood that folks would be able to stay in their homes, that they'll get the resources they need, that we make the changes to plans and policies, that we really start thinking ahead about building resilience, not just for areas of growth, but for where we live today, for existing housing and communities, and for future communities. The strategies look at new and rebuilding around the region, because those two things will happen, and then, as I said, existing communities. And then lastly, before we switch over to seeing the project live in WebView, there were a couple types of strategies that we ended up developing. They're state-led strategies, and it's important to know that there's some things that the state needs to do. There's different kinds of mapping and guidelines and education and outreach that really needs to happen at the state level. It's most appropriately housed at a state agency, and it will help statewide resilience if we take these actions at the state level. There's also regional strategies that need to be advanced. Some of those address sort of regional and cross-jurisdictional issues, shoreline management programs that need to cross over jurisdictions, advocacy up to the state and federal level for changes to help us in recovery and financing recovery appropriately, and a couple of other strategies that need to be regionally led. And then the majority of the strategies are locally led strategies. There's a role for the different levels of government, state, federal, and regional in these local strategies, but they really are targeted at reducing development in high hazard areas and retrofitting fragile housing, improving standards for new construction, and managing our hazards, both for flooding and seismic, preparing for post-disaster recovery. It's a very big challenge. And then, of course, communicating or coordinating with our nonprofits and community organizations so that we can advance this understanding of hazards and how to prepare yourself and become a more resilient community out into those neighborhoods and communities that most need to understand that information. And with that, I'm going to switch over, and Dana is going to present what you can find on the Resilience website. And let me see if we can do this in some sort of magic way, right? Yes. Dun, 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 dun.
Thank you. So I am one of the ones who had ankle surgery recently, so I'm going to try to just reach over and not have to move my body. But we wrote up the findings not only of our analysis but of our strategies in a couple of different ways for various audiences, including our online report, which is on the ABAG Resilience webpage. So here we have sort of a shortened version of the report where we have an introduction to the project, an overview of all of our analysis, and this is pretty interactive. We have several pop-ups, so you can dig into the data as much as you want. You can just read the summary, or you can open the tables and see where we got the data from. So, for example, here's a pop-up that shows the different hazards that we used and what scenarios that we used. We have also links to... It's a little flip. Slow to load, but we have links to the different shaking scenarios that we used so that you can actually see what that shake map looks like. We have links also to the flooding scenarios that we used and the sources for those. Again, all of our fragile housing types are all available there if you want more information on that. We also have our regional maps available at a larger scale, so you can click on those and they will load and you can zoom in and look at your own community. We have those for our housing indicators, our community indicators, and then the combined, so you can see where there's overlap between fragile housing and communities at risk. And then we also have here... the introduction to the strategies and a table that outlines several financing mechanisms that could potentially fund these strategies, as well as the strategies, the applicable strategies where you can use those financing mechanisms. So this is all available if you dig into the website. Also on the website, we have the summary report in PDF form, which is essentially the same information that's available here if you want to download it, print it, make it available to other people. And then we have a much larger strategies manual, and this is where you will actually dig in and find all 40 of the strategies, and I'm just going to go over what one of them looks like so that you're familiar with the format. Let me get to the... So each strategy begins, this is a long one, each strategy begins with this summary table where we outline the lead, which Wendy talked about, what the scale of benefit is, whether it benefits an individual resident, a whole community, or the region, whether it's new or existing development, and then which of our indicators it addresses. So what hazard, what community characteristics, what housing type. And then we came up with six different types of action categories. Is it an evaluation program? Is it a code? Is it a policy? And then we outlined which strategies are either prerequisites or related. Then there's a... Oh, yeah. Sorry. There you go. Now you can see it. So this is the snapshot of the strategy. Then there's a description, which basically outlines why the strategy is needed, why we decided to develop it, what it says, and how you might start laying out how to implement the strategy. So, yeah, this is a long one. We have a bit on governance and implementation issues, which is what conflicts might you encounter in terms of other policies, other issues that community members might come up with, what challenges you might encounter at other levels of government, and then how you might start to think about overcoming them. A table that highlights which financing mechanism you might want to use. So for this one, it's grant programs. Implementation partners at different levels and how you might benefit from a regional or a state partner in the implementation of the strategy, and then examples of how other people have done this, what references you might want to use, what guidelines you might want to use, and then links to those. We are working on this webpage. We're working on a separate page that has all of the strategies organized by the three different criteria, the level of implementation, the hazard, and then the indicator, the community indicator or housing indicator that it addresses, but that's still under construction. But when that's done, you'll be able to click on this link, go to a separate web page, and there will be pull-down menus, and you just select whatever criteria you want for each of those, and then it'll pop up the five strategies that you would use that address those criteria. So that's coming soon. Check back. I don't know when our webmaster has time to help me with that. And then the last thing that we have is our technical report, and USGS was one of our funders, and they're very interested in sort of the science of how we did this and how it translates into policy. So this is the very nitty-gritty details with all of the sources and information, but you can see that as well. We'll also be making our community profiles available on the website shortly as well.
That's it.
Okay.
So there you have it, and not sure if there's any questions yet, but real quick, to what extent have we reached out to maybe counties? I know that in Alameda County, we've contracted with a company that if, you know, there's a major disaster, they'll come in. They're already set up. And then has there been any thought or have you done any reaching out to EBRCS, which is the kind of the joint communications group? Because I noticed earlier you talked about the transit dependent, and I know that on our communication system that is put up between Contra Costa County and Alameda County, there is a plan to bring transit agencies in.
So you're asking, have we just initiated a conversation?
Right, with either one of, well, first of all, I guess the county going ahead and contracting, I mean, I don't know if that's something we want to encourage other counties to do. I think that's kind of where I was going with that. But then The regional communication, I mean, even for the transit dependent, I think is very important. So I just want to know where you were at with that.
And are you asking in terms of preparing for a disaster, responding to disaster, or recovering?
I think, to be honest with you, all three.
All three.
Yeah.
I think there are some specifics of those pieces that relate to the resilience of the house, whether it gets wet or whether it breaks. There's a more comprehensive effort, which will be the regional resilience plan, which connects to the local hazardous plans. And at that level, we're coordinating with the efforts that are going on at the county level and at the city level. We did a major outreach mailing to all the planning departments, city managers, to identify whether they want to coordinate and collaborate with us in some of the data gathering, sharing some of the strategies, and collaborate across cities and across counties. So we'll give you some more specifics on that at the next presentation.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Well, Mark?
Zoning. We talk about housing, and in one of these events, and I looked at the pre-event model ordinance that is on your website. I just looked it up. And in an old community like mine, there's a lot of non-conforming housing and non-conforming uses. And I'm sure it's the case in a lot of the Bay Area. An event happens, and, you know, well, you can't rebuild that. So what can we, I mean, should we have a pre-event zoning overlay or something where you can, in the event of an earthquake, you will be allowed to rebuild? Because there's probably going to be, just in my town, there would be 100 to 300 units, which we possibly couldn't hold a public hearing on in 2 years' time to determine, well, it's a non-conforming use, yeah, you can rebuild it. And that's almost always residential in nature. And that's just in Martinez. And I can imagine this problem would be exacerbated throughout the East Bay or wherever the event was. So should, in the model pre-event model ordinance, or how could a community, shouldn't we give a template of how a community can anticipate in the event of a natural disaster that you will be allowed to rebuild a non-conforming use to some degree? I know it's every non-conforming use is quite odd, and it may be unsafe.
That's why it's not,
but
conforming.
That's going to be a huge hindrance. And then you have the insurance question. Not all insurances cover you in the event of an earthquake, but if it's a non-conforming use, more than 50% of the building is damaged, and they say, well, if you can't rebuild it, we're not cut, you know, you're not covered, the mortgage is still due. Those are very complicated issues. I don't know if you can handle them in a pre-event model ordinance, but just on giving guidance that maybe in the event of an earthquake, non-conforming uses to some degree would be allowed to be rebuilt. Is there some way we could address that?
We have started some of that conversation primarily within the priority development areas, where we are able to pay more attention to what are the existing zoning codes, what could be rebuilt to at least existing envelope, and what's the capacity to accommodate new housing, because we know that in the event of a disaster, it's not just rebuilding, but trying to build fast for those units that could not be rebuilt. I noticed that Cynthia also has an additional.
I wanted to add a little bit to both of the earlier questions. I was also involved in this project. On the non-conforming uses, there is a strategy that suggests that cities look at how their policies would apply in rebuilding, and are there cases that they want to set aside to handle differently post-disaster than they normally would. So that could be addressed as part of that effort. More broadly, there was the question of, was Alameda County involved? One thing that the presentation didn't stress, but that also was part of the project, was that there was heavy involvement of local jurisdictions, of community organizations, and the whole process of identifying the indicators, the measures that we used, and also of developing the strategies. So the particular context that Scott mentioned didn't come up, as Miriam pointed out, because it wasn't specifically a housing issue, but there were many opportunities to bring in information on what places were doing.
And one last question unrelated to housing would be telecommunications. Do the service providers for telecommunications have the ability to ramp up in the event of an event And if they don't, should they be required to?
I want to point you, actually, we did another report on the performance of infrastructure, and that may also answer both of your questions. And it's on our website. It's called Cascading Failures, Earthquake Threats to Transportation and Utilities. So I would point you to that report.
Dave, did you have something?
Yeah, real quickly. Actually, it's already it was just addressed a little bit further by Cynthia, but we just had a very, very similar presentation at the committee I chair, the County Board of Supervisors, our Housing, Land Use, and Transportation Committee, which had absolutely no reference to regional participation, looking in the other direction from the county back to the region. And of course, given the various roles I've played here over the years, I questioned that. So it just seems like maybe it's just a cosmetic thing at this point. Obviously, housing is a subset of everything else that we're discussing in terms of resiliency and in terms of disaster preparedness, preparation, and the whole resiliency subject. But, that even though that was coming before our Housing and Transportation Committee, it did not specifically drill down into the housing issue, but just the lack of credits going back and forth, you know, between the regional agencies and the county, I think it's just kind of the kind of omission that causes people at the local level, especially those that don't serve at the regional level, to have this huge blind spot. You know, it's kind of an omission. There was no way, unless you came to meetings like this, that two or three of my other colleagues or people at the county that are involved otherwise that are sitting in that room listening to that meeting would have any idea that this is going on at the regional level and vice versa. So I just want you to know, I said the same thing to our county folks, but I don't want to pile on. I just wanted to, I think sometimes it helps to reinforce a topic that's been brought up by one or two members of the body here. So thank you.
Now our resident expert, Mr. Wagenknecht. On earthquakes, anyways.
Yeah, we lived with an earthquake, and we're seeing it that we may have more in that regard. But in strong and safe housing, I was wanting, and you were mentioning that you were also working in to work on drought and wildfire. This may be a more chronic issue, but the air. Being on air quality, the air would be one that it'd be nice to come up with standard design to help these scraps of land that we're building our affordable housing off and on is often in these troubled zones, and that would be a good area to look at.
Going back.
Thank you.
I'm trying to move around.
No, I appreciate that.
Go ahead, Mr. Vice Chair.
Two comments. One on the pre-planning adoption. I think there are huge difficulties in that. However, I think that some models of emergency ordinances, as was done in Oakland after Loma Prieta, may be a very good thing. Because, and not to say take that one, but at least from that kind of experience, so you could have some models that in the event of one of these emergencies, could quickly be adapted. The second piece about knowledge of this, what is the plan to get this information out to the cities in the Bay Area? Or, asked slightly differently, are you going to do a version of taking art on the road?
Taking on the road is a little bit more complicated, but what we're trying to do is, again, leverage the synergies and try to bring to the cities not just this report, but some of the other reports as we do our rounds related to Plan B area. So we have a much more concerted coordinating effort. We are trying to make use of our website and the very close interaction we have with the planning directors. That's our stronger connection to the local jurisdictions. We meet with them regularly. We interact with them regularly. We attend their meetings. They come to our meetings as well as with the CMA planning directors. So we will use those fronts to, we're using already that to share that information. Is it enough? Probably not. So any feedback on that front in terms of how we can share this information more effectively, it would be helpful.
Can I just follow up briefly just for Zach's knowledge that we are taking all of the information that we've learned at the regional level and bringing it on board into the Contra Costa County adaptation project that we're starting right now or we have initiated. We are using it in our Oakland Alameda focus area work, and we will be carrying it with us wherever we go. We do talk about it when we do Art on the Road because we find that this is such an amazing project for people to really get the resources they need to start understanding housing and communities. And it is going to be brought through into the local hazard mitigation plans through the work that ABAG is doing with our assistance on hazard mitigation climate adaptation. And in that way, it can also be downscaled to the either the city level, like the city of San Rafael is very interested in doing, or even the neighborhood scale.
Anybody else?
I will also like to mention that as part of our hazard mitigation plan and climate adaptation plan update, we're working on developing a few of these strategies more deeply and providing model ordinances and guidance. We're working on that throughout this year. So the hope is we have several ordinances that we've collected from around the region already on our website, but our hope is to add more value to that and add more context and guidance and make those available to governments, local governments as well.
So I'd like to struggle with one last question. I was talking to somebody earlier this week who actually owned a house in Napa where the home during the earthquake shifted, I think it was 4 inches off the foundation. And it kind of struck me, it was a bit odd that I bought a very old house in Livermore, several years back. And in order for me to purchase the home, it had to be secured to the foundation. Is that not the same in every county, or is there an ordinance for that, or?
It's local, so.
It's a local ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
So do we encourage, in all sincerity, we could have saved this person probably, well, we couldn't have, but by that jurisdiction having the ordinance, they could have saved that person probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000.
That's true, yes.
So should we be encouraging, should we find these jurisdictions that don't have ordinances like this and kind of push this upon them?
We can't push.
Well, I get that. But, we have a lot of elected officials sitting around here. And,
yes.
And, you know.
We should be promoting it. Yes.
That's, better word, promotion.
Yes, we should be promoting it. And that's actually one of the and Danielle will emphasize this more, but that's one of the main pushes that we're doing in this project to develop model ordinances because it's an easy fix. And it's, as you said, it could save a great deal of money.
Go ahead.
I'm Danielle with the Resilience Program at ABAG. I just wanted to also add that through our Loma Prieta 25 conference, which we held in October, one of the policies that we'll be promoting was to encourage safer housing, both for single family, addressing the cripple wall issue like you discussed, and the multifamily soft story issue. So that's a policy that was adopted by ABAG's executive board, and we'll be taking that out throughout the region. And then leveraging the toolkit project, which Shana talked about, where we'll be specifically developing those ordinances so they're ready for implementation and adoption by the cities.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Bates.
Yeah, just a quick comment about that. So I think the toolkit is great, and I'm glad to see my city is well represented because we're on this stuff. One of the things I would suggest, though, is that you also need a community resilience strategy about how neighbors and other people can also stay in place and how they can fight and how they can secure. So I don't see that up, and I'm wondering if you're doing that now. In other words, we have these caches all over town so people can make, cut out cars, get people out of cars. They have ways to fight. They're trained in first aid and things of that nature. That's also extremely important.
Julie.
Yeah, just a question. This is really good information, and I think there are far too many of our colleagues who are elected officials but maybe not serving on regional bodies who ought to hear this information. Are you aware, available for things like conferences of mayors, where I can get, you know, close to 100 people who are in positions of authority around local governments together and do a presentation like this?
We'll be happy to bring that to any of those conferences.
Okay. I didn't want to offer it as a program until I asked.
Okay. Supervisor Joy?
Just to add on, Tom, on your comment, there is, I'm seeing develop a pretty strong network of folks in some communities. I'm seeing this in parts of Richmond, of on a very localized neighborhood basis, where they understand that emergency response may not always arrive for several days, and how to make a neighborhood very self-sufficient for a week. And apparently there's a model out of Seattle, and what they've done is they've ordered the whole sort of publication checklist out of Seattle, and they're using this, and it's very evolved. And it seems to me, just taking the approach, unfortunately, rather than have to get the material from Seattle, it would be useful to sort of get that material from the Bay Area that's more unique to our area. So they're using the template, and it's not something that government's organizing. It's something that they're just sort of assisting getting information, and it's very well developed. I won't go into details here, but the purpose is having neighborhood blocks be sufficient. And so we can help as a region be a clearinghouse for the information, and I can pass along the material from Seattle that they provide to their neighborhoods, and it could be a good thing that we provide in the Bay Area to neighborhoods to help them.
Just one quick response to that. Thank you for that. We'll be happy to take that input. One of the components of the regional resilience plans that we're working on and in collaboration with the cities is to identify those local community networks. While our effort doesn't focus necessarily on immediate emergency response, one of the components that really increases the long-term resilience is the availability of local networks, community networks, where it functions as an education process, but also in terms of identifying the resources in the case of an event for a more grounded recovery. Thank you for that.
I also want to mention that as part of our hazard mitigation plan update, we're holding a series of workshops throughout the region, and the first one is next week in Berkeley. We'll be holding one workshop in each of the 9 counties, and the first series of workshops is actually on community engagement. So this is timely, and if you're interested or if any of your city staff is interested in attending these workshops, there's more information on the ABAG Resilience website, which is resilience.abag.ca.gov.
So there you have it. We're going to move on now. Thank you for that wonderful presentation. I hope you all take care of yourselves in future.
Yes, I won't rub off.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, I break bones all the time. It's no big deal. Okay, so now we're going to move to item 5. Which is the recognition of Bruce Reardon's work with the Joint Policy Committee. And I would like to say that one of the things about me serving as chair is I realize when there's always somebody better to do something. And although I've admired Bruce's work since I've been on the JPC, there is somebody here that's known Bruce much longer and has worked with him much more intimately. So I would like to ask that Mayor Bates present a certificate of appreciation.
Great. It's a pleasure to do this. Bruce is a wonderful constituent and has made a great contribution to this organization. This is a proclamation that's put out by the Association of Bay Area Governments, Air Quality Management District, BCDC, and MTC. This is Bruce Reardon in recognition and appreciation of service to and leading climate change efforts in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know what, Bruce? I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to read all. I'm just going to get the highlights. So Bruce has been a member of Al Gore's Climate Leadership Corps and an early volunteer, and he's been involved immeasurably in working with doing planning and convening in the Bay of people like the Air District. He's had summits in 2005, 2006, 2009. He's been involved with key milestones in launching the Air District's Climate Protection Program. He's also played a great role here in the Joint Policy Committee on Climate Strategies, working with the public and local regional agencies. He's played a major role in the JPC Climate Strategies and informed the Bay Area Climate and Energy Resilience Project, which is an ongoing network of over 300 organizations. I think this is a major major contribution, which we really appreciate, in public, private, nonprofit stakeholders. He's also been involved in the role as and also in the same kind of work, catalyst and active in the Climate Readiness Institute, which is another great accomplishment, I think. It's an academic partnership between UC Berkeley, UC Davis, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and a little college on the peninsula, junior college on the peninsula, University of Stanford, and has also served as a mechanism to research policy stuff. This is, I think, an ongoing important opportunity for us to see how we can really examine the issues of climate change on a much broader and much more intellectual level. So on behalf of all these organizations, Bruce, we wish you the best, and thank you very much for your service for this organization.
Tom, you can give it to him. That's his now. And Bruce, you go ahead.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a couple of remarks. I have Tom and I go back to when I was 10 years old because I watched Tom play football for Cal. So we do go back a ways. Thank you.
Tommy.
Yeah, that's when you played defense. They scored against you.
That's I got to say, as a 10-year-old fan, Tom, you know, we knew Joe Capp and George, you know, a whole series of people. Your name wasn't one of the ones on the playground that we used all the time, but happy to have watched and seen it happen. And happy to be one of your constituents for a number of years, too. So a couple of things. First, thanks for the opportunity that you've given me over the last 5-plus years. To serve you and to serve the regional climate effort. It has been an adventure, and thank you for that. Secondly, your agencies, the four here, have done some fabulous things and are doing some fabulous things, including one we just heard about, in the time that I've been here. I won't take any great credit for the initiatives they've put together, but things like the Regional Climate Protection Strategy now at the Air District, BCDC leading the way in the region and really in California with sea level rise, that kind of leadership, MTC and ABAG with Plan Bay Area, with the OBAG funding, with the BayREN program through ABAG, the resilience program now. I mean, these are some very good things that you're putting in place or have put in place. The climate is not going away, and they're going to be more and more needed. So congratulations to the agencies for taking that kind of leadership here. Third, I would just like to mention three things that we've done in the last couple of years, and Tom mentioned a couple of them in the proclamation, so thank you. We did them in your name. We did them with your funding. It always wasn't obvious how we could bring them here and that you could hold on to them and they would become yours. That's a problem, or that was a problem. But let me just say a few minutes about what they've done for your cities and your counties and the other constituents that are out there. We've done it with your funding. So BASERP, the Bay Area Climate and Energy Resilience Project, we've worked with your cities and counties quite a bit over the last couple of years. We've got a network now of about 300 stakeholders on adaptation. The needs assessments we've done, they particularly liked it that we came out to each county and asked them, what do you need to move forward and how can we help? Workshops and webinars in this room on a variety of topics attended by as many as 150 people. You know, the whole point of that project, we got the Kresge funding for two grants, Kresge Foundation, and you probably heard me say 18 times that we were going for a bigger Kresge grant that was going to allow us to really set up shop as a regional network in a bigger way, and we were not successful in getting that at that time. But the new Alliance for Climate Resilience that Larry and Allison and others are working on, I think, is going to build on the foundation we built there, and it looks very successful and likely that Kresge and others are going to fund this new ACR, which will become then more of a coordinating body for the region. But we brought Kresge here, and we got them interested, and that was a big step, and the first two grants. ARCA was the other, with the state. We formed this alliance of San Diego, LA, here, Sacramento, and now the Sierra region. We have five regions with the Governor's Office of Planning and Research to learn from each other on climate adaptation. And it's a good framework. I don't think it's anything to write home about quite yet, but the framework is there for the next few years as we move into adaptation. There are now four bills on legislation that have been on adaptation that have been introduced in Sacramento, and ARCA members had a part in that. We got resilience into the guidelines for the cap and trade funding, things like that. So ARCA, I think, is a second one, and that will continue here as well. And third, the Climate Readiness Institute, where we're slowly working out a deal that I'm going to work there. This is where we've brought together Berkeley, Stanford, Davis with practitioners, and this is something that Will Travis and I had the idea to go up and talk with Berkeley and talk with Stanford. We weren't after an institute. We were after help and resources, but it's the way they do things. And so we now have a Climate Readiness Institute headquartered at Berkeley. We have our first donor funding, and our first grant is going to go to Christina Hill and College of Environmental Design to work with BCDC and others on a sea level rise project. We're working on a follow-up workshop in May on water and drought for cities and counties here. It'll be a follow-up to the ABAG Spring Assembly, so we'll coordinate with ABAG on this in terms of coordinating on how much help cities and all and counties want now on facing the drought that we're facing. And we're doing a summary right now for the Air District of climate impacts in the region that can be a part of the climate protection strategy. So those are three of the things we did in your name and with your funding. I thank you for the opportunity to do those things. And more importantly, those constituents, both here in the Bay Area and in the other regions, thank you for your funding and support. Last comment for me, and I didn't bring slides today. I saved you from more slides from me. I've been here a little over 5 years, and we know a lot more about climate than we did 5 years ago. A lot more research has been done here in the Bay Area and in across the country. And to quote one of the White House scientists that we heard from last week, nearly all the news is worse. And on the adaptation side, we like to talk in long, decades and multiple decades, and California temperatures over decades are going up. But it's interesting that this was the warmest winter ever on recorded history in the Bay Area this past winter, that California was the warmest it has been in recorded 115 years of recorded history for the last year, that we're in the fourth year of a drought, and droughts are coming more frequently now. We've always had them, but the frequency is definitely ramping up in the last three decades. That we have more West Nile virus in California. We have mosquitoes in San Mateo County now that carry dengue fever. That could carry dengue fever. They are the types, and we haven't had those types here before. The allergy season is longer. The fire season is longer. We have more extreme storms. If you look now at the graphs of rain in California, it goes up and down with these atmospheric river events. The background kind of normal kind of rain that we used to get is just kind of going along. But these atmospheric river events, we're either getting them or we're not. So we're getting a drought and then a big rain and a drought and a big rain. All of that is worse. So the point is, and final point here, I hope that you can focus here on things that really matter. Because if we just keep busy and do small things, our lives and the lives of our children and grandchildren are going to be in great danger here, to use that word. And so doing things at the scale that the problem requires, so things like the Regional Climate Protection Strategy, that has the potential to really be the first one in California that can really take a region and do this kind of work on GHGs. Early on here, we talked about Marin Clean Energy as the only community choice aggregation set up in the Bay Area or in California. We now have Sonoma and Marin and San Francisco coming along, and studies being done on it in Alameda and San Mateo counties. That's an example, again, of a strategy that can move the needle on electricity generation in this case. So there's a great opportunity this year. California has got new bills that have been introduced, SB 32, to extend the AB 32 to 2050. There's going to be a big debate over it, but it's going to raise the whole discussion here. And internationally, I think my friends that work internationally for the first time in a couple of years are slightly optimistic about what's going to happen in 2015. The China-U.S. agreement that was reached, not the numbers actually, but the ability to reach an agreement and to show the world that the two biggest GHG polluters were going to work together on various items was a big breakthrough. And most of them think that this is going to turn 2015 and the Paris talks into something different than what we've seen, and that provides a great opportunity for you here. So thanks again. I've appreciated working for you.
Thank you, Bruce. Where are you going, Allison?
I'm just going to the...
Oh, good. Okay, so thank you, Bruce. Thank you for all your hard work, and appreciate everything you've done. We're now going to move to the minutes, and I know they were moved by Cortese, and they were seconded by Zachary Wasserman, so I appreciate that. Is there any objection to the motion? Thank you. The motion passed without objection. We're going to move to the very anticipated organizational planning. Gina Bartlett is back with us. Something wrong?
Excited that you're excited.
Thank you. Yes. So go ahead, ladies.
Thank you, Chair Hagerty, and thank you, Bruce, for it's been a pleasure to work with you this past over a year, and excited to work with you in your new capacity at the Climate Readiness Institute. I think you're not going away, right? We're going to continue to work together. So we have been engaged for the last 6 months in the development of an organizational plan, and we're going to go over this with you and ask for some decisions today and some which we will have for discussion in May. So why don't I hand it over to Gina, and we have organized this presentation. I'll start with you, and then she'll hand it over to me.
Hello, everyone. Nice to see you again. So today we're going to talk about the new name. We have a proposal on the work plan out of your last meeting when you gave direction to focus on climate change. We're going to introduce the governance elements, have an initial conversation on budget development, and then seek your approval of the governance structure and the organizational plan elements, and then come back to you in May with a more formal budget for approval. For some of you who are newer to the committee, this has been a six-month process that we started in September, and the charge was to focus on the structure, the work plan, and the governance of the committee with an eye toward maximizing impact of your efforts coming together. This is just to demonstrate that we've been here, we've been meeting with the executive directors, and we've also met with the deputies and the planning directors to develop the materials that are before you. And they're really intended to be as responsive as possible to some of the things that we learned from you kicking off this process, and to use your time as effectively as possible into the future to make sure that you're able to carry out the work plan tied to climate change that Bruce has eloquently sort of set up for us with his overview of what's happening. So today, Allison's going to walk us through the elements of the organizational plan, and then, as I said, next time we'll come back with a formal budget for your approval that will support implementation of the organizational plan as well as the work plan.
All right, so I'm going to go over, and we'll come back to a conversation if you'll give me just a little time to go over the next couple slides. We're going to talk about the name change, and then also I'll go over the proposed work plan with you. This, after some conversation at our last meeting in January, we went back and looked at a lot of different options, looked at, you know, say what the acronym spelled, and tried to move away from anything that would invite ridicule or anything like that. And we landed on, and it may not be ground-shaking, but it is something to discuss, the Regional Collaborative for the Bay Area. And so that is on the table as the name change for the Joint Policy Committee. And there's reasons why we went forward with a name change.
there is a lot of the Joint Policy Committee, that name really focused on this, the Board of Elected Officials. It did not capture the great work that's also underway among the executive directors and the staff of the agencies that is really what you saw a demonstration of with the presentation earlier from ABAG and BCDC, a lot of great work that's underway among the agencies around, that is addressing this issue. And I think by moving towards a name that really captures the important work of you here and also the work at the staff level, would really reflect the work that's underway and the true integration and the efforts of the agencies in trying to work together and do as Bruce inspired us to do to really address this issue of climate change in a meaningful way. So what we reached in January at our meeting was agreement on focusing on climate change, me focusing a lot of my time with the staff on climate change, but keeping an eye on other regional issues, not losing that. There will be other issues brought to this the governing board here. But the benefits of doing that, as a reminder, especially for some of the new members that this are walking into the end of a process, that all of the agencies, all four of the regional agencies, have a mission orientation towards climate change. There is this focus on, and I think a real opportunity, which we've heard about, this connection of providing services to cities and counties and doing it in a much more coordinated way and trying to make it very focused and easy for cities and counties to get the information, the assistance, the best practices that you all need to accomplish what you're doing in your community. Many of the smaller communities in our region just can't build out the capacity to do some of the climate work. And how can we make that really easy for you to get a hold of the best practices and adopt them in your own city or county? I'm excited, and I thought having Abby Hall here from the EPA, and there's lots of other opportunities to strengthen our relationship with state and federal agencies, get more funding for our work here. I think we're only going to be more stronger by demonstrating that we're working together and putting forward a coherent regional voice on these issues. This issue isn't going away. It's pervasive and enduring, and how can we partner with the state who has been a leader, but how can we continue to lead with the state and provide a real model, not only for California, but for the rest of the world, frankly. Oh, that didn't show up, did it? That's too bad. You should all have a copy of the work plan. Okay. I'll just go over. I'm not going to spend a ton of time, but it's important to keep in mind, if you just look at the graphic here on the front page, this graphic, all the information around the what would you call it? The gears. There's more detail on the second page on the types of activities that fall under each of those items that are on the gear. But this is a demonstration or an illustration of the kind of work that the agencies are engaged in. The mention of the regional climate protection strategy that the air district's involved in, the regional adaptation plan that both BCDC and ABAG and MTC, all of the agencies will be working on, the sustainable community strategy, and then this other gear around regional leadership and engaging with a lot of stakeholders and the networks around the Climate Readiness Institute, the Alliance for Climate Resilience that Bruce mentioned, and then this whole element around policy and resource development, this work with the state and federal agencies. If you think about this from a longer arc, there's some details at the bottom around what we're going to be focusing on this year, but this is a longer arc. This is us working together to work towards achieving even more outcomes that reflect the integration of the agencies and working together. If we're moving beyond 2017, can we develop the intention around developing a regional climate strategy that's really thinking about mitigation and adaptation at the same time? We've just had a meeting recently with Caltrans and MTC and BCDC, really taking on what was done with housing and community resilience. How are we doing that same level of work around our transportation infrastructure? So really advancing all of this work is helping us as a region advance towards a fuller understanding of these issues, the kinds of solutions and strategies that we need to employ to address them. And we can only do that by working together.
Yeah, I think we're at the discussion. So we've talked to some attorneys around what the kind of motion that would need to take place and the exact language for doing that to have a name change. So there's some suggested language there. There may be discussion around that, and if there's any discussion related to the work plan.
So we'll deal with this now.
Yes.
Okay, we're going to deal with the name change. Mr. Wasserman.
I would so move, as stated on the slide.
Let's see if we're that lucky. There's this motion and a second by Chavez.
Was that question?
And so, Sperrin, you wish to address this board?
Well, yeah, I'm sorry to hear we had a motion and a second. There was a lot of discussion last time, and at our last MTZ ABAG planning committee, we talked about how we could have either titles or subtitles that the average person could relate to. For me, this is just a step backwards. I mean, when you put regional collaborative, it's just a red flag, in the region, and here we got regional government. And I don't think it really reflects the communities working together. And I really felt that we had to make it more local. And the last discussion we had, I thought that's the direction we were going. This is a great title for all of us policy wonks. And for staff, I can see why you'd come up with that. But I really think for getting public support and to have, as diverse as our counties are, I just think that we needed to have a title that was just a little more reflective of our local communities working together. And so I was disappointed in the title, but I'm sure I'm in the minority. But, I would like to open that discussion.
Okay. And as the chair, once a motion is made, I'm compelled to allow that motion to move forward until so we can get to the discussion part of it. So now we're discussing. Julie?
Well, ordinarily, I likely would agree with my esteemed colleague. However, in this case, we really are talking about the regional agencies and how we're trying to collaborate to work better together. That doesn't say, and I agree, and I was the one that raised it at our joint meeting last time, about how our plan for the Bay Area that we are all building together needs to be bottoms up, and that needs to be local collaboration for regional success, to tap the name that was offered by my colleague here, Mark Luce, or something similar. I understand people are working with that, and we've got some experts in those kinds of messaging who are talking about it. But in this case, we really are talking about how the regional agencies collaborate. So I guess in this case, although I don't think it's all that great a name, I can't think of a better one, so I'm okay. But okay. Maybe we say joint policy subtitle or this and then formerly known as.
Nah. Anybody else on this item? Supervisor Joya?
I think the terms Bay Area, the term regional, and the term collaborative, all I agree with. I would like to maybe have a little discussion about the order. I think it is much simpler to say Bay Area Regional Collaborative. I do understand. I understand. People are going to make fun of these words in whatever order they're in. And we also have to make this simple. I realize there was discussion about Bay Area Regional Collaborative and BARC. I don't see that as a big issue one way or the other. People are going to figure out other ways to be critical if they want to be critical. So I just submit and throw out there, do we want to change the order so it, rather than it have, three extra words, that it's Bay Area Regional Collaborative or whatever, some alteration of that as opposed to the Regional Collaborative for the Bay Area, which just sounds so much more complicated.
Okay, as I move to Supervisor Pine, I would just like to say I normally agree with all three of the speakers, but I don't have a problem being called BARC. It doesn't bother me, and I think it is a little difference to leave the where our location out. So I'll move to Supervisor Pine.
First off, for those who I haven't met, my name is Dave Pine. I serve on the
San Mateo County Board of Supervisors and BCDC and ABAG, so looking forward to participating with this group. And not having been here before, I hesitate to chime in, but I will go ahead and do so. First off, the word regional is just critical. I mean, we have to bring our constituents along on regionalism. They don't like it, but it's our only hope as a nine county region. And then I strongly support John's perspective, and I guess Scott's perspective about putting the Bay Area first. I mean, when you bump into people or talk to the press, you can't say that, that it just doesn't work, the regional collaborative for the Bay Area. I mean, it just doesn't work. And, there's plenty of precedent for strange acronyms. I would submit that ABAG is kind of a weird. Now, let me give you the one that my 14-year-old just thinks hilarious. I serve on the very important but yet obscure SF Bra. So, I mean, let's not hassle over this thing.
I serve on that one too with you, Dave.
I mean, it's just when I really want to promote this group and this work. And when I meet, a council member from City of San Mateo, I don't know how to say regional collaborative. I want to say, hey, Bay Area Region Collaborative. It's great. Right. It has to be that way, I feel.
I'm going to make a friendly amendment then, a friendly amendment to the motion.
And
you need to get the motioner and the seconder.
The maker of the motion, and I believe the seconder, would accept that and change the motion to Bay Area Regional Collaborative. And I think it's fine because it's actually, like it or not, accurate.
Yes.
We may bark, we have no bite.
Right. we'll see about that.
So there we go. That's very good.
Okay, so if I'd like to move this along. Is everybody okay with that? Okay, so I have a motion and a second. It was an amended motion that now calls us bark. Is there any objection to that motion? The motion will pass without objection. Thank you. Yeah. You can all go get a dog bone or something.
It'll help with the logo, so thank you for that. Did we want to have any discussion on the work plan? Was there any?
Oh, yeah, that.
And I do want to welcome, thank you, Supervisor Pine, welcome to your first meeting, Supervisor Chavez, and we had, and Supervisor Marr, thank you. I think those, and then we had Councilmember Gupta was our first time last meeting, so thank you.
Okay, so let's move on. The work plan was before for you. Did you have anything else you wanted to add to it?
No, I just wanted
okay,
to
say. Okay, so are there any comments?
Any comments?
Councilman Ross.
Thank you, and hello, fellow collaborators. And I said, bark, bark. So I said this at Monday at the executive committee, so that my fellow Air District collaborators will have heard this. And I was speaking fondly that I was playing the role of Jim Sparing on Monday, and I will do that again today. I think that the mention of climate change, the economics of climate change, and that we're having an economic climate change alongside of our actual weather climate change is important. And if we're trying to get buy-in on this with a lot of people, I think that there's a business community that needs to be sold and be told how the economics of climate change can be favorable, how this in the long run is favorable economically, and there should at least be a subset mention to our mission, if not a co-equal part, that the economics are, if you don't believe in just the plain problem overall from top to bottom, if all you care about is money, and we know that there's a segment that doesn't care about it unless it affects their business, and those are key players we've got to bring in, and I think that the economics of climate change should also be addressed somehow in our mission and somehow in our work. That's all.
All right. Collaborator Wasserman?
It's better than conspirator.
the couple of comments. I think the work plan is very, very good. I think it's very good guidance. There are two areas in which I would suggest a small change. one is on page... Sorry, I had it. In the governing process, where it is...
So, if I can interrupt... We're going to get to the that's the organizational plan,
sorry,
and this is the work plan.
I was jumping ahead. I apologize. I'll be quiet.
Oh, it's okay. But yeah, so this was just referencing this conversation to this, but we are going to get into the meat of what your...
Thank you.
Okay.
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 Okay, go ahead. I'm going to have staff finish, and then we'll vote. You got it?
Okay. Next. Okay.
We should reference the document.
Yes. So it is in your packet, this document, which... Zach was referencing the organizational plan. And this is really going to serve as the bylaws, if you will, or the organizational document with some guidance as to some basic governance issues. There are some changes that you will hopefully vote on today. The proposed governance structure is that there will be this governing board. We will phase out the executive committee, and I think this structure. And I will say that through all the conversations that we've had with the staff and with all of you, we really focused on what's the structure that will help us achieve what's on here. We'll use your time efficiently. Allow me to make these meetings as productive and useful as possible. And so we proposed meeting this group, meeting quarterly, reducing the representation from each agency to 4 board or commission members to serve annual terms. The chair and the vice chair would serve 2-year terms and really encourage rotation among the agencies in terms of who is chair. Encouraging, not requiring, but in terms of rotating among the agencies to have chair representation from them. Yes.
Just to make it clear, the chair and vice chair of
this organization
would serve 2-year terms. Not
yes.
That the chair and vice chair of each of the organizations would serve 2 years on this chair.
Yes,
just want to make sure
your organization now too.
Don't worry, Zach. You can stay longer than 2 years for BCDC.
I have a constituency of 1.
Yeah.
So each agency selects your representatives. You each have your own system of doing that to serve on the governing board for BARC. and so that will continue. It does not have any requirements that it has to be the chair or the vice chair.
And the governing board selects its chair.
Scott.
And then the governing board, you as an entity, the governing board, elect your chair and vice chair for this governing board, just to be clear. Okay. There's a question.
Why are the board members only serving a 1-year annual term? 1 year. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and there's a reason, and it's driven. The Air District has just 1-year terms, and so it was a way to reflect. We have 4 agencies reflect their time frame for
MTC's 2. So we get a chair, they make the committee appointments, and that's 2-year term. So
right.
So each agency can do multiple years and say you're going to do it for
Very
the next
good.
2
okay.
years. That's but we just made it 1-year term so that it meets the Air District can only do 1 year. So that way. It doesn't preclude anyone from serving multiple years. It's just that way that it's 1 year across the board, but each agency can multiply that if they'd like. So.
Okay.
But that way we don't have to, have every different agency's...
That Air District just makes everything different.
I know. Julie.
Oh, Julie, go ahead.
Refresh my memory. I thought the statute that created the Joint Policy Committee specified 5 members.
It doesn't. It just requires that all 9 counties are represented. but it does not specify how many members.
Hmm. Okay.
That may have been developed because to make sure that you captured all nine counties. Yeah. And so this group, the governing board, each year, the executive director of the Bay Area Regional Collaborative would develop a work plan. That's a two-year work plan. And working with the executive directors and leadership of the agencies, develop a staffing plan for cross-agency work teams to accomplish what's written here in the work plan. And that it would come before you, ideally at the May meeting. Right now, we're doing this to align with the development of the annual budgets for each of the agencies. That will come before you at the May meeting in anticipation of the approval of the budgets at each of the agencies.
Okay.
But we have one more segment. If there's any questions on the governance.
So if there's no questions here, I'd like to keep moving, finish the presentation, try to take it all at once. Good, thank you.
All right, so also in your packet, you have the work plan. For the first time, we propose developing a budget. And on the last page of your packet, we went through an exercise of identifying or estimating what the budget has been for this last year of the Bay Area Regional Collaborative. So I've estimated that out, and this captures both in-kind and cash contributions from the agencies. And so you can see there the budget is around $500,000. So this is intended as an initial conversation. You don't need to decide on the budget. I'll bring forward a proposed budget for this next year's work activities in May. But the point for the issue to have, or the conversation to have today, is what is the best way, maybe as you would think this is the best way, but what is the best way to structure the financial contribution of each agency moving forward? You can see how it's broken out among the agencies currently in terms of the in-kind and cash contributions. It came up at a meeting with the executive directors to bring this to you for a discussion. I think the Air District and MTC have been carrying the bulk of the expenses, and we should have a conversation about is that how we want to move forward, or is there another way to structure the financial contribution? Some equity and cost sharing, not necessarily equal, but based on each agency's budgets and the constraints within their budget, is there some other approach we may want to have?
That's it. Okay, so why don't we take a shot at that, since it's fresh in our mind? If you look at the totals between MTC, the Air District, ABAG and BCDC, does anybody have any thoughts on the amount of contributions and or in-kind? Supervisor Sparing.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming the executive directors have talked about it. Yeah. You know, I mean, if I wasn't on MTC or Air Disc, I'd say this is a great budget. But I would like to hear from the executive directors. Are you comfortable with this? And I mean, is this something that meets your budget? Within your budgets and all.
Commissioner, I'll speak for myself and Jack can as well. I am not. I think it's inequitable. And if we can't reach quarters, you know, a quarter for each, I think there ought to be some minimum that's considerably above the contribution that is currently coming from the other two agencies.
Don't beat around the bush, Dave.
No, and I would just echo Steve's remarks as well. We thought it made sense to have this conversation now as we have a new organizational plan. We have a budget we're trying to put together, but you can see that it's somewhat inequitable considerably. So it makes sense for us to talk about a minimal level of contribution, we think, from all four agencies.
Ezra.
Yes, I think ABAC can step up on the in-kind services substantially from where it is today. Of course, we're not equitable agencies. I mean, there's no comparison between the four agencies with respect to resources that have been awarded and authority from the state, presumably with the intent of creating a regional collaborative like we're discussing. So I would automatically assume that the two agencies with the major financing capability would be providing a lot more of the resources that they get from the state and over the authority that they're given from the state. That said, we, as executive directors, were told that we can come back and make a counter proposal to the way that things are currently configured. I have a lot of sympathy for Larry, for BCDC, because they're locked down as a state agency. They have very little discretion. At least in ABAG, we have a few enterprise units that can, you know, produce a little bit of cash for us. But our reserve is meager for our operating agency. And as you know, we've just been hit with this embezzlement that one of our enterprise units, it's costing us a considerable amount of time and energy. So we're not really, I think, in a position to be applying much cash in next year's budget. One other, I think, key point. The policy work that's intended to be accomplished by the collaborative around climate change is something that ABAG has been very successful in attracting grants from around the state and the federal government. We contribute a tremendous amount of work in the very field that we're attempting to collaborate. So while we may not have cash for the staff, we are providing a very large amount of a body of work that is used by the that will be used by the collaborative for the climate change agenda.
Larry, did you have any thoughts?
My one thought, because I would agree on with everything that's been said, I would say one more thing, which is that I do think it's really, really important for each of the four organizations to have skin in the game that is very, very tangible and actually has some kind of effect on the budget of the organization. So we are very limited because we're a state body. So we don't think, candidly, we can actually cut a check to the JPC from BCDC or to MTC or something like that. But we will get to the point, and we will get to the point soon, that we can figure out, and Steve and I have already started talking about this, about how we can work together in a way that actually provides some kind of support at a level that I would hope, and I know that Jack and Steve would support. Because if we don't, then it really hurts the structure and the strategy of the whole organization.
Okay. Yes, Supervisor.
Yeah, I'd like to just continue. This question's for Steve and Jack. Does this budget have to go back to both MTC Commission and to your boards?
It does in a way, Commissioner. And I think one thing that's healthy that all four of us agree about is that we ought to present this board with a budget. You know, most boards have budgets, and your budget has sort of been invisible to you because we've been passing the hat and kludging things together. Our intention is now that not only will our contributions be approved by our boards, which has been happening anyway, but that this board would approve its budget and be in control of its budget.
Director Sparing, so for the Air District, what we would do is we line item this contribution in our budget, so it's very explicit. That's what our intent is this year. Okay. So, you know, in the past, what we've done is we've just included as part of, under a heading of regional collaboration or something like that. So this year we plan to make sure we identify the contribution by the district.
Okay, so do I, what I'm hearing is that the four of you are suggesting you convene and you're going to discuss this. And, you know, for me, I really think there needs to be some minimum number for contributions into the JPC or our new organization. And I don't have any problems with in-kind or however it does, but I do really, and when it comes to MTC or the Air District, that's certainly going to be my position in both of those places, that each agency has a, and if we have to do something, you know, on behalf of BCDC with either some legislation or something, I think we need to do that. But I do feel that there should be a minimum amount that each agency contributes, and they're obligated to do that on an annual basis.
Okay, so as I'm hearing it, oh, Dave?
I just have a question for, I guess, any of the directors, but particularly the two agencies with the least discretionary budgets. Is for something, I mean, it strikes me that the work we're doing here is so important, especially around issues like climate change, that there would be some grant writing opportunities to support the work of those agencies that don't have big general funds. And I'm wondering if, A, if that's plausible, and B, if it is, if there's a commitment, you know, among those agencies, I guess the two of them, to, to sort of put your shoulder to the wheel and try to get that done, so that, you know, it is a more equitable contribution.
Yeah, I agree with the same comments of BCDC. ABAG has been very aggressive and successful in winning grants directly related to this subject matter. But those grants are written very precisely and audited. So we cannot just siphon money from that into the salary of an individual who's not part of the project. Now, to the extent that we can find a grant that we can write in the executive director and relieve some of the burden of the cost, we would do that. But that hasn't happened to date, because we have to identify every staff person who works on these grants and their level of expertise in order to win them. And we have this ongoing consultation with these funding agencies as to our work and their expectation of our work. So our discretion with the grants is very small, and I think BCDC will say the same thing. That said,
I wasn't referring to past grants or existing grants, Ezra. What I'm talking about is, you know, utilizing federal lobbyists that these agencies have, even if MTC has to help out with that, and trying to figure out where ABAG, for example, can go to EPA or Department of the Interior or, you know, state-level or agencies and pursue new grants. I guess what I'm really asking is there the to borrow on a policy term, is there the political will at your level and at BCDC's management level to actually go, you know, look for those grants, pursue those grants, and at least invest in the grant writing to try to win grants like that would support this work?
Yeah, I mean, both ABAG and BCDC are mature organizations that have, you know, really worked hard on its own funding and putting a financing program that keeps us going. We would love to have grants that would authorize our mission in the Bay Area. And foundations may be the better place to look. So we reevaluate that strategy every year. Allison has come up with some possibilities. We talk about this.
Thank you.
Zach?
Thank you. Like everybody else, I sort of agree with all of the comments, recognizing they are not all consistent. Some proportionality makes sense, whether it's quarters or comparing our budgets, I don't know, and would defer to the executive directors. I agree with the skin in the game concept. We are under probably the most severe restrictions because our budget is primarily established by the state, by the governor, and approved by the legislature. We have made some decent strides in getting some increases, certainly support the going after grants. And indeed, we have formed a nonprofit, Friends of BCDC, in part to help support our 50th anniversary activities, which will be happening this September, and you'll all hear more about that, but in part to serve as an ongoing recipient of grants from entities, mostly foundations, who won't typically make grants to state agencies. So we absolutely support that. Having said that, grants are very important to carry out the kind of work that this organization does. Grants are an absolutely lousy way to sustain an organization. And so as everybody, and particularly the staffs, think about that, we need to come up with a balance. But we'll certainly pitch in and absolutely agree with the principle. Our ability to deliver dollars at the moment is fairly restricted.
So I think at this point what I'd like to do is kind of move everything but the budget, or ask somebody to move everything but the budget, ask the executive directors and Allison, our own executive director, Allison, to work with the other executive directors to come up with a funding plan that maybe they feel is more equitable. And I guess at some point white smoke will come out of the roof of this building and say that they all agree and we can move forward. So does that work for everybody?
Can I just raise two quick questions about the document?
Go.
One is on page 6 involving government decision making. I think the consensus approach makes perfect sense. I do think we are a public agency, and I think we need to leave ourselves the formal fallback of a vote. Last resort, but I think that needs to be there. And as it's written now, it would be easy to argue you're essentially prohibiting a straight-up vote. And I think that would be wrong. So I would like to see that change made, added as the sort of the last resort. The second change I would request is on the issue area regional task forces potential. as it's currently written, it says governing board members shall not serve on them. I don't know why there's an absolute prohibition. I understand that you want, if you're going to do it, out there, but it seems to me, depending on what the issues are, there may be very good reasons for members to serve on it along with non-members.
Okay, so anybody else? Julie?
Yeah, under the staffing, I guess I'm a little concerned, and I haven't, I mean, it's the first time I've seen it, so it's an issue. The cross-agency staff teams on the middle of page 9, I'm fine with the executive directors and deputies selecting which staff would serve on some cross-agency staff teams to collaborate on some of this work. I'm a little hesitant to say that the collaborative executive director would manage the staff time. I'm a little concerned that that takes away the ability for the home agency to make sure that their work gets done. I don't think at ABAG have a lot of extra staff time. We can just say unilaterally, here, you get a quarter of a person for the next year. Use it as you wish. I think it's got to be a little more collaborative than a shall kind of a thing.
Yes.
Just a concern, and I would leave that to my executive director to hash out, but I am concerned.
The intent was, and maybe it's not clear, but I just wanted to reflect the intent. The intent was that the executive directors and deputies would approve the staff time to work on, like, the resiliency chapter of the Sustainable Communities plan, for example. So that would be approved, and then it would be the collaborative executive director who would be, you know, bringing the staff together, kind of organizing the team's work plan.
So coordinating.
Yeah, it's more coordinating is probably a better word, but that the executive directors would approve that time. That was really the intent.
Just, it just reads a little clunky there.
So can
we can modify that.
We'll just put the word coordinate there.
Or works with. Instead of manages, yeah. Works with.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
I just had one suggestion. Somewhere under intent, or where we have policy focus under climate change, we're talking, like, for example, under the climate change, we talk about provide better services to local governments and special districts that are grappling with these issues. One of the concepts, and we can just, it's a few words, what we're saying is that we're trying to improve how local government and special districts perform here. It's really about improving things for Bay Area residents. I mean, we're talking about bureaucratic institutions rather than people, and it just seems that concept under the intent or policy focus needs to get reflected, because it's like, oh, these are agencies, they're working together, coordinated policies, better services for local governments. Well, all of that is really on behalf of people, the people who live in the Bay Area. So it would be nice to at least reflect here that this is being done to provide, you know, to improve the quality of life for Bay Area residents, something to that effect, so that it comes down to a real people level and not just about institutions. On page 1, somewhere under the intent, you know, it's this learn, explore, collaborate. I mean, we're using all these words that we use in government, best practices, so agencies can decide collectively, and you know, all of this. But nowhere are we talking about this improving quality of life for people in the Bay Area.
And it should be in the first line.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this is really about. It's about the work that we do in our agencies to improve the Bay Area.
Okay, so nobody else that's really...
And I don't need to wordsmith it. That's just the concept
that's
you figure out.
That's where we're getting here. So, Pradeep, did you have something?
Yes. Thank you, Scott. This is not to change or comment on the draft of things that the staff has put together, but there was an intention of the from the excerpt of the legislation, and it's on page 7, not page 7, page 3, which says that in the third paragraph from the bottom, that this Joint Policy Committee shall comment on major interim work products in the final draft, comments to prior action by ABAG, MTC, BQMD, and BCDC. I'm just trying to clarify, does that imply that the action of approving a particular policy or action by individual agency will be approved or discussed and approved after the comments have been made by JPC or the corroborative in front of them, or it's the other way around, that the final product, commented product, from the agencies is brought to this corroborative? What's the sequence here in terms of the final approvals?
We're looking at you.
Well, I mean, if you read it,
the final approval is by the individual agency. This committee reviews and provides comments, but does not approve.
Go back to the agency, the comments from
correct.
The...
Right. Correct.
And what we try to do as executive directors is when something comes up that we are pretty darn sure is going to actually affect one of our co-agencies, we bring it up early and we try to make sure that nothing is put into that process that would get one of the other three agencies going sideways on what we're trying to do, for example. So we do that in a very collaborative way. Jack did this last year, I think, really well when we started talking about the Office of Health Hazard Assessment with regard to how funds for cap and trade were going to be developed. And we ended up with a 4-agency letter that went forward. And so that's an example of how you can take one thing and actually make sure that everybody comments on it and gets a far better product.
So, but just to reemphasize, the final approval of a commented draft will be still lying with the individual agency.
Correct, because
thank
correct.
You. Thank you.
This collaborative is advisory.
Yes. Okay, so. If there's nobody else wishes to speak, there will be an amended motion. The amendments are, well, there's, when you move forward, this will be added in the motion. So go ahead and capture.
So the changes that we've recorded are to add into the intent the linkage to helping Bay Area residents and improving the quality of life in the Bay Area. That's on page 1. On page 6, under the governing board decision-making, to add in a backup vote provision so that if you are unable to reach agreement that you will have a backup vote protocol. And then on page 8, under the issue area regional task force, to change it so that governing board members may serve on those task forces if they wish. And then on page 9, under cross-agency staff teams, changing the language so that it reflects that the collaborative executive director is not managing but coordinating or working with dedicated staff and developing the work plan deliverables.
There you have it. Did that capture everybody's comments?
May I comment?
Yes.
On the issue of the vote, I'm not quite sure what the meaning of the vote is. The three agencies cannot tell MTC how to spend the money in their RTP. We are an advisory collaborative. So when we vote, we're just expressing that advisory signal maybe in a stronger way, but it doesn't have any actual authority over the agency's individual actions.
Go ahead, Zach.
I agree. We have no bite. However, I think there may be times when a majority wants to go on record saying something, and as without that change, I think it could be argued that one single member of the board could prevent it taking any action at all. That's all I'm really trying to address. It's not in any way to bootstrap us into having power over any of the individual agencies or any of the individual cities that we do not now have and are not seeking.
So I think that was well said, Zach. So would anybody like to make a motion to approve this based on the amendments that you heard?
So moved.
Moved by Zach. Second. Seconded by Pine. Is there any objection to the motion? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
Mr. Hager, can I get clarification? I mean, does that mean that this body could be in conflict with the Air District, MTC?
No, we're only advisory, Jim.
Well, the way that Zach was describing that vote, I just want to make sure that we don't end up with this body in conflict with one of our four partners. I think that's a disaster, and it's something we have to avoid. And so if that's what's being recommended, I am very concerned about that.
I would just point in the organizational plan, it says that each agency is independent and will move forward its own initiatives. It does not provide in any way for this governing board to block one of the agencies. It's written in here. So that's responsive.
It's not block. I mean, it's political posturing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of factors here. And, mm-hmm. and you know, to have the people that oppose a lot of the stuff that we do to say, wow, you got this agency saying they shouldn't be doing it, yet they're doing it. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's not as simple as us sitting around this table. So I just want to make sure that we don't have that conflict, and we need to make sure that we avoid it in what we're adopting.
Zach?
I agree with Jim. I think a vote in the circumstances you describe would be a very bad thing. And I think that each of us, when we have our hat for our individual agency, recognize that if we're going to do it to that agency, it could be done to us, which I think is a very strong deterrent. But there are issues that we may wish to take a position on that are not saying BCDC should not do this, but rather that are regional initiatives, where an individual here could have a very strong feeling about it. And I just don't want to let that totally stop it. That's really what I'm aiming at.
And I don't agree with what you're saying. I just want to add, I agree with you. Okay.
Any objection to the motion? The motion passes without objection. Are you guys done now? Okay. I need a motion on the minutes because I know Alice has just been waiting for me to do that. Moved by Sparing.
Second.
Seconded by
Second.
Joya. Any objection to the motion? The motion passed without objection. I will note that is 11:59 and we are adjourning this meeting. Hold on. Oh, I'm sorry. Sit down. I did. Jean Kramer, you wanted to speak on item 7. Where is she? Do you want to speak, Jane? Well, come on down. You're the next contestant.
Okay, I'm just speaking as somebody who's spent a lot of years, a lot of time in community-based organizations. If you really want to enlist the energies and the enthusiasm of neighborhoods and community-based groups to network for their own self-interest, present your agenda very simply, but in terms that particular neighborhood or community quickly understands is of benefit to them. So what I'm saying is, don't come over to them as being tyrannically administrative straitjacket. They need to feel that they can talk with you, they can give you their input, that they've got ideas, that you're receptive to those ideas, may not always your action may not always be to their liking, but they've been heard, the air is cleared, and make their contact persons accessible. Don't make the administrative working so complicated that they don't want to deal with it. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane. Appreciate the comment. With that, we're adjourned.